Good morning, diners and travelers of the world, and
are they diners or diners today?
Yeah, that's like that standard.
Guess who got out of bed on the wrong side this morning?
Oh, diners and travelers of the world, unite. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
With a giggle to start your day.
Exactly.
And we've got a rather conventional program today. It's just about food and wine.
Exactly.
that's a little bit unusual. Sometimes we've been straying away from that, but we're straightforwardly about two excellent and exciting restaurants, one just newly opened, and then we're going to turn the clock over to a couple of very interesting people talking about, rather controversially, about wine. So that's what's ahead of us today, but...
Let's launch out with Richard.
Should we launch? Okay.
Yes.
First up is a friend of an old friend who recently opened a outstanding Oriental restaurant here in the city of Pittsburgh, which we call home, and he calls Pan Asian. Okay, so let's...
Well, we talk about that in
the interview. So let's hear it for Richard Chen.
On the Menu is sitting here with an awesome duo. We have a Michelin star chef, Richard Chen, and we have Simon Lewis, who comes from England via Chicago and via Las Vegas. You two just opened probably the most talked about restaurant in Pittsburgh called Richard Chen Pitts. Welcome to On the Menu, both of you.
Oh, thank you.
Let's just give people a sampling of what you were about, Richard. What is some of your background?
Well, my background, I work with my dad. He was a chef as well. And I grew up practicing in the restaurant business when I was little. And before I graduated from high school, I realized that's something I really love to do is in the restaurant business. So I move on with my career and choose to go to Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. And after I graduated from the culinary school, I want to find more of the Western style cooking and try to find out what is on the ingredient, what they use. So maybe in the future, I can combine East and West idea and ingredient and also seasonal item. So make the menu more interesting and more tasteful.
Now, you started doing that at your restaurant in Las Vegas, right?
I started doing it probably a while back in Chicago.
Okay.
I kind of started out probably 1991. That's when I started really taking East and West and combine the idea. And at that time, I realized that almost my menu, I can easily come up with new dishes and change as the season goes. So it's not like you see the menu from day one and 5 years later come back still the same menu.
But tell us about your Las Vegas experience.
And Las Vegas right now is probably, they try to mainly become the entertainment of the world. And people, we have about 3 million visitors a month just visiting Las Vegas. And people go there, really want to have a good time, entertain by going to the show, also going to the fine restaurant. And now in Vegas, basically, you can find all the top fine restaurant in the country is all there.
And your restaurant is in the Wynn Resort.
Right,
it's called
Wing Lei.
And it is a Michelin star restaurant, the only one in the country, I understand?
Correct.
The only Chinese
restaurant, right.
Now, is it fusion there too?
Well, we maintain basically 30% of another traditional Asian dishes and maybe 60% of Western Caucasian Chinese menu. And the other 10% I do what is a seasonal menu. I change it quite a bit, like a fixed menu.
And here you are in Pittsburgh. Let's talk to Simon for a minute. You're from England?
Yes, I went to culinary school in the Colchester Culinary School in England. I did an 18-month apprenticeship at La Tolle Booth in Constable Country, and then I came out to America and have worked for chefs such as Richard in Las Vegas, Rick Tremonto in Chicago, and Gerald Robuchon in Las Vegas.
A British chef end up cooking Chinese food, or Asian food, it's called?
I love the flavor from Chinese food. I love just having simple ingredients and putting, you know, 2, 3, 4 flavors together, and you just get that pow in your mouth. I mean, it's just incredible.
I'm going to ask you something. There are a number of people here who have, I'm going to put it this way, followed Richard from Las Vegas to Pittsburgh. And this should not embarrass you, Richard. Everybody just says once they work for you, they don't want to work for anybody else. You have a lot of fans out there and a lot of staunch supporters.
That's true.
Do you think is what makes this the situation, Simon?
Richard is an amazing chef. The greatest chef I've ever worked for with taste. I mean, Richard's taste is just off the charts. He's very quiet, very humble. He doesn't get stressed out at all.
He's cool.
Very relaxed, very cool. And he's just, you know, an amazing chef and a good friend.
Yeah, well, I mean, he married one of my best friends, so I think he's pretty good. Which brings us back to, you were still at the Wynn in Las Vegas, but you, what made you come and open this restaurant in Pittsburgh? I guess Kathy, yeah?
Yeah, Kathy is the main reason. She lived in Pittsburgh almost over 33 years now. And after we got married 2 years ago, I started visiting in Pittsburgh. And
we might point out that Kathy has a restaurant called Yafe.
Correct. And so we started dining out in Pittsburgh area. I realized, wow, there's a lot of different variety of restaurants in Pittsburgh. And we kind of talk about it and say, well, Pittsburgh can use another restaurant, something what I've been doing all my life, and try to bring the power of the Asian cuisine back to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, well, you've certainly caused quite a stir in Pittsburgh with this restaurant. It's, first of all, very beautiful. Can you describe the design? Give credit to Edge, too, because they did a fabulous job.
Yes, and we, from the beginning, when I talked to the landlord, Steve Mercedes, and when I saw the space, the next day I lay out the whole design of the restaurant. First, I want to make sure the customer had the best prime location in the space, and also the worker not interfering with the guest dining experience. So you can see the worker kind of tuckered away doing their side jobs and get everything ready. And meantime, the workflow for the server and the staff in the back is very important. So almost like every inch of the equipment put in this restaurant just calculate perfect execution of the layout.
Well, it's very restrained, and yet it's very dramatic in the decor as well, which supports the style of cuisine. Would you be able to venture a brief description about the style of cooking, either one of you or both?
So we take classic Chinese dishes, but we mix Western influence techniques and styles of food preparation and ingredients to mix and change, which causes Pan-Asian style food, which is what we do.
Now, what are some of the favorites turning out to be? You seem to have a really good selection of dim sum, which is all I've heard about Pittsburgh is there's no place to get decent dim sum, and now there is. Is this particularly popular?
Yes, our dim sum is very popular. We have a crystal shrimp dumpling. We make the fresh dough every day. We use some of the best products that we get from either in Pittsburgh or from surrounding states. We try and use as much local produce as we can. Dim sum seems to be very popular, as well as I think our top seller right now is the five-spice duck that have on our menu. So
what distinguishes that from the traditional preparation?
Well, the five-spice duck, mostly in American culture, the duck always tastes dry.
Yeah.
And that will be the last item people will order. But when you come to visit Richard Chen, duck is, I can create any kind of duck dish preparation throughout the year and different recipe, and my duck is supposed to taste very nice and moist and very flavorful. And that's something that usually become 8 o'clock, 8:30, that's when you will notice the duck will run out of the menu.
Oh dear.
And we're having a hard time to keep it up.
Now, I mean, a lot of Chinese restaurants, you don't see lamb on the menu, and here you have Elysian Fields lamb.
Well, the lamb is it's out there in Asia. I mean, like Mongolia, they raise the lamb or the sheep out there, and it's just like not that many chefs want to create the lamb dishes because in Asia, the lamb is very tricky to work with because sometimes you can, if you can, all mutton, and when you taste it, you can get like aftertaste, and Asian people sometimes do not care for it. And that's why you don't see that many lamb dishes on the menu. But if now, in this case in Pittsburgh, we use the Elysian Farm They have the best lamb in the country right now. They carry to all these famous restaurants in California, in New York. And we're so fortunate. It's almost like a neighbor. They deliver to us, and we can able to dress it up and put on the plate, and you can taste the meat. It's so fresh, and there's basically no odor or anything. I mean, the meat qualities are unbelievable.
I mean, there are a lot of surprises in the quality of local produce in southwestern Pennsylvania. Have you decided or discovered that also?
Yeah, we have. We're trying to use as much local produce as we can. We have some great vendors out there that we're using. So we try and use as much as we can.
Well, you know, I want to try some of your traditional sounding dishes, especially the rice dishes, to see how they're different.
Well, the rice dishes, I mean, for example, right now we have three kind of rices on the menu. One is jasmine rice.
I love jasmine rice.
Yeah, that's probably my all-time favorite rice. It's, rice is so fluffy. It's not sticky, and it just had a little bite to it. So I like my pasta or rice dishes have like a little bit chewy al dente taste. And we have a brown rice, and brown rice right now is very popular as well. People are very concerned with their health. And the red rice is another addition, and something is, it kind of depends your mood and what type of rice you like to have. But I can guarantee you, like, you pick any one of them is a winner.
Well, you know, the other thing about, you mentioned healthful concerns. You have a light touch with most of your dishes and with your sauces.
Yeah, most of the, every dishes I really try to work with salmon and also with the kitchen staff, make sure that everything we do, we take a lot of pride and something we enjoy to eat ourselves as well. And something we like, we want to make sure every dish is coming out from the kitchen, it should be the same going out to every table. And I noticed my style, I like a very light, nice, heavy, greasy, something that's kind of, I've been trying to stay away from it from years ago.
Right.
So basically, Pan Asian style cooking is my own definition, basically refine the dishes. You take a lot of Asian root and try to meet with the Western style of cooking techniques and also ingredient we have from locally, and try to bring every component and put it together and put on the plate and serve it to the guests.
Now, the other thing that I've noticed is usually you don't get this level of desserts as you have here in an Asian restaurant. Am I wrong in that?
Yes, well, I noticed myself the food business for the last 30 years, and I travel quite a few restaurants all over the country. I notice everybody, when it comes to dessert in any Asian restaurant, almost like it's so disappointing. Almost like I always say to my previous boss, it's almost like have a flat tire at the end of the meal. It's just like came out fortune cookie or like a lychee in the can.
That's it.
Right.
Mandarin orange segments.
And right now we try to, Simon and I also, we have another pastry assistant. We try to come up with ideas. Like right now we try to come up with a fall dessert menu.
Uh-huh.
And because right now our dessert menu has been selling. Every table almost before they leave, they had to make sure they have the dessert.
You know, I must admit, I have not had, but I'm going to remedy that. I will try these desserts. Do you make these sorbets and ice creams in-house?
Yes, we do. Everything in-house, from the beginning of the menu to the end of the menu. Everything's made fresh.
Simon, you're a marvel. What was it like moving from Las Vegas to Pittsburgh?
Oh, it was lovely. It was nice to see green. Green, lush Pittsburgh. Coming from Las Vegas, I spent 3 years living
in the desert.
I had a great experience there, but it's nice to be living in such a lush, green area.
Yeah, and your wife is from Colombia. Is she
That's
happy
correct.
Too?
Yes, very much so.
And tell me, now, can I ask you, like, how are you going to divide your time between Berg and Las Vegas, Richard?
Well, I'm trying to come back very frequently, much as I can, and with my schedule and plus the busy seasoning is coming up in Vegas and assume over here as well. So you probably will still see me like 2-3 times a month, and I will fly back and forth and make sure that everything is run smooth and anything I can support with salmon, also at the front of the house, and make sure we really keep up our standard up.
Well, I mean, I trust Simon. I've only met him recently, and I just you're dedicated.
Thank you very much. It's my passion, so I love doing what I do every day in, day out.
And how about a website?
A website, like this Saturday, we have a professional photographer plus another professional digital video consultant that's coming in. And we try to have picture taken around the restaurant, the front of the house, the outside and inside, and plus the salmon going to make some dishes, and we're going to try to get this ready so we can get a website for the
But the website's there already, but I think at the present time you have to make a reservation by making a telephone call.
Yes.
Peter just wanted to pick up the phone because we know that on the menus listened to around the world and certainly around the country, so when business or pleasure brings you to Pittsburgh and you're from out of town, please note that it's about a 10-minute taxi ride from downtown if you happen to be staying in that area. So it's very easy to get here if you're involved in the medical complex at all. That's even closer. That's only practically walking distance away. So it's not just for people in the Pittsburgh area. It's for people around the country, and we hope Pittsburgh visitors will welcome. And one last thing we should say. This restaurant wouldn't be here, incidentally, in Ann and Peter's neighborhood if it were not for the East Side development, which Steve Masaitis diligently pursued for about 10 years before he managed to get it off ground. Richard, we welcome you to our neighborhood. We're delighted you're here, and we wish you every success.
And that's for me, too. Yeah, love it. So happy Mary Kathy came to stay here. And good talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, and that was followed by a very exciting dinner, and now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And don't forget, email us at any time the address onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
We're crossing the country now.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Well, I do that all the time.
I have my hand out waiting for
words to come out of your mouth so that I can borrow them. This is across the country in the United States and across the world in terms of cuisine. An Italian-inspired restaurant in San Francisco.
Nate Appleman, I said to you, I don't think that's an Italian name, but you are an authority on regional Italian cooking, particularly the area in the south of Italy. True?
That is absolutely true.
And how did this happen?
Well, as a young cook, I was in love with French fine dining, multi-course tasting menus, and after 7 years of cooking, I had an opportunity to go and live in Italy, and I jumped on board, and I just fell in love with everything about it, and it really gave me a focus on what I wanted to do in life, and it was cook rustic Italian cuisine.
And did you live in the Mezzogiorno?
Well, no, I actually lived in Tuscany, but I've traveled extensively throughout all of Italy.
Uh-huh. We're just leaving for Bologna. I expect I'll get right back in the Italian food mode right away.
Mm-hmm.
Nate, you are a chef, restaurateur, and now cookbook author. And your cookbook is called A16, Food and Wine. Could you explain your title?
Well, our title comes from the name of our restaurant, A16, which is named after the highway that runs through southern Italy. It runs from Naples almost to the Adriatic side, near Bari. And our food and our wine the inspiration comes from that area around the highway.
Well, we've been on that road.
Yeah, we drove that highway now. Somehow or other, we must have gotten off that highway because you don't drive it, you don't back into a ditch on the A16. And I managed to do that in a place called Benevento, which you said before the show you knew quite well. There isn't a plaque there that says this is where Peter drove his car off the road.
Now, how is your book organized? I mean, I can look at it and say that your co-writer is Shelley Lindgren, who's also your wine program expert.
And my business partner.
And your business partner.
Yeah, we decided to do a book on food and wine, and the first part of the book chronicles the different regions in southern Italy. And the way Shelley organized it was by the highway, just like the name of our restaurant. So each chapter in the wine section is it goes by highway and region.
Yeah,
so she has a highway in Sardinia, and she has a highway in Sicily, as well as highways throughout the provinces of the mainland too, right?
Yeah.
And she does a wonderful job of naming all and describing all the grape varieties and the kinds of wines that they make, and is clearly very, very well informed. A lot of people wouldn't drink a wine from Campania if you gave it to them and paid them.
Exactly.
And they're clearly missing out, and she understands that very well.
Well, how many people have ever heard of Falanghina?
Well, we've drunk it lots of times.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, it's not exactly.
Well, we're doing our part to change the world.
Yeah, the first time we were in Naples, I ordered a white wine, and I had to struggle to remember the grape afterwards, but it was Fiano d'Avellino, which is just an absolutely excellent wine. And now I've tricked a few people that I've taken out to dinner by ordering a wine and then saying, now where is this one from? And they don't get Campania within 1,000 miles.
Right.
So it just shows you now that the granddaddy of them all, of course, is Primitivo probably.
Well,
which people say
it's definitely one.
Now Tarassi,
Tarassi being the main grape of Campania.
Okay, the Tarassi. This is the wine that comes from the center of Basilicata.
And also from Campania.
Okay, and that's a red mostly.
So now we have you, part two. Food.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I have to tell you, I'm so impressed about your tattoo sleeves.
Yeah, it's quite a collection.
How long did it take you to build that?
Well, I've been doing that off and on for 11 years.
I mean, some of it looks like World War II.
You know, I like someone to come into the restaurant and eat what I'm cooking, I like to find a tattoo artist and you know, find what they do best and let them go to work.
Oh, great. Now, you have an introduction about why you're in love with this style of food. Then you have discussions of you have two wood-burning fireplaces in your restaurant.
Correct.
And one is for pizzas.
Yes.
And the other is for everything else.
For almost everything else except pasta.
Oh, yeah.
Although, you know, we'll do an occasional lasagna out of the oven.
And you have a section called pantry. And I was really thrilled to see. I mean, I had never actually thought about it, but being Sicilian in background, this is all stuff that I've just always had in the house.
Right.
It's great, except that we never had preserved Mara lemons.
And you also won't let me make charcuterie.
No, that's true.
Now you do that though, correct?
Correct. We do it all in house.
I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but you have this section on salt, and I noticed that desserts use salt in the dessert section. Is that traditional?
Well, I don't know about traditional, but it definitely makes a better dessert.
Oh, it does that, but I thought these were just all traditional recipes.
Gather inspiration from Campania. It's not necessarily that these are the recipes from Campania. It's my take on, you know, how I feel when I'm actually in the region, and it's a mix of traditional dishes and also dishes that I've been inspired by.
So you created dishes, if you like, in the style of the region.
How I feel Campania is. What it means to me.
So you're not like those ladies, that, what are they called, rather? The ones that started out in Bologna, and you go to their house and they cook only authentic traditional stuff.
Oh, it's a group called Home Food that somebody from the University of Bologna organized. Sort of like a parallel track to Slow Food, but in a different kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
You have then after that sections according to the forced food part of the meal.
Yeah, the sections on our menu.
On your menu, those are on your menu, and you have one that I was really crazy about called the pig.
Yeah, we love the pig around here. I'm actually, you know, we love whole animals. Our whole cuisine here at A16, it really is based around using whole animals.
I love the section where you talk about when the neighbor's staring when the butcher comes with the big pieces of pig.
Yeah. You know, it's just something that we truly believe in, and you know, a lot of people seem to enjoy it because we have a great following here.
We have a wonderful before and after picture, Nate, of a porchetta, a whole porchetta that was prepared around Easter time in the city of Pienza in Tuscany, and we took a photograph of it Friday evening when, of course, no one could eat it.
Yeah.
And then we took another picture of it on Monday, and it was almost all gone.
Yeah. Now, tell us about this. You do a lot of fresh homemade pastas, huh?
Yeah, we do. We actually do pretty much everything in-house. If it can be made, we do it.
Uh-huh. The macaronara is what? I mean, what? That's a chewy kind of pasta, you say?
Yeah, it's a chewy noodle. I would liken it to almost like a udon noodle.
Oh,
it's,
okay.
It's made up of mostly flour and water with the tiniest bit of egg, and that's one of the main differences between southern and northern Italy. Northern Italy, it's all about a silky egg pasta. In the south, where it, you know, always been a very poor region of Italy, they couldn't afford to put eggs in the pasta, so it's mainly made up of flour and water.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly an inventive cuisine derived from poverty, right?
Poverty, yeah.
I remember the first time I was ever in that region. It was in Catanzaro province at Nicastro or something, and visiting a friend's family who she had been separated from her family since her father escaped poverty and came to the U.S., and they treated us royally, but they broke out the salumi they had preserved that was going to be the only meat they had throughout the whole winter. And it was like almost eating something sacred. It was just so,
right.
And they were very poor people. What are your favorite things? And here's the recipe I'm going to try to get Peter to do, get me to do, is braised goat, tomatoes, rosemary, cinnamon, and white wine.
That's
the silicone.
That's one of my favorites.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good recipe.
Absolutely. Okay. If you can find a good quality goat.
We have a lot of it. I mean, it's very chic now.
Yeah.
Goat has become chic. That's funny. And the other one I'll never be able to do is this rabbit mixed grill, which is loins, ribs, legs, and belly marinated with black olives, preserved lemon, parsley, and chilies.
Well, I absolutely think you could do it. I break it down in the book. There's, I don't know, I think 16 pictures on actually how to butcher it. So I don't think it's something that you should be afraid of. It's chronicled right there in the book. It shows you step by step on how to do that.
Thank you for reminding me that this is one of the things I love about this book is you have photographs illustrating the steps in creating these, especially the butchering part.
Mm-hmm. Well, we wanted this book to be approachable by everybody, not just professional chefs.
Yeah, I've never seen a book that tells you how to bone and stuff pig's trotters. That makes it like something I would maybe even approach.
Yeah.
I can just see you doing that.
Well, why not?
Well, why not? Well, then jump right into it.
Anyhow, is there anything that you'd like to mention that we've neglected in this talking about the book, Nate?
Well, we're very proud about it. We put a lot into the book. I wanted to get into as many hands as possible. The photography is amazing. The stories, I believe, are amazing. It's a price, so I urge people to get out there and get it.
It's on our website, so anybody who wants it can first of all read about it, description of it, and also order it right from our website. And I think everybody should come to your restaurant, too. I mean, I intend to do that. I don't know how I've missed it all these years, but it
sounds
wonderful.
Make sure you don't miss our other restaurant, SPQR.
Oh, that's right. Tell us about that.
Well, it's once again, it's our take on a Roman osteria.
Oh, I love it.
It's a mix of traditional Roman food, but also, once again, food that I've been inspired to make while in Rome.
Oh, I love eating in Rome.
Would you like to tell us a couple of your favorites, Nate?
At SPQR?
Probably A16, since that's the one you have a cookbook out for. Maybe the SPQR cookbook's coming next.
Maybe. Some of my favorite dishes in the A16 cookbook, definitely the pizzas. It's something that we take very seriously around here. Pizza has had kind of a resurgence in the last couple of years.
I love pizza.
And we break it down so you can, we give you alternatives if you don't have a wood-fired oven on how to make a pretty darn good pizza, out of the book.
Right. Oh, it looks heavenly. I love pizza. Peter's not as crazy about it as I am, but I could eat it all the time. It's a perfect meal.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I had another question. Now it slipped my mind. Oh, shoot. Oh, I know what. Because jumping back to the Roman food, you had a recipe in here of the pizza with that, what's it called? The Tuscan, what's it called? The Tuscan kale. What's it called? It has so many names.
Well,
you know what I'm talking about?
We call it dinosaur kale here,
yeah,
I guess.
Whatever.
It's otherwise
you know what I'm
known
talking
as,
about?
I don't believe I have a pizza with kale on it.
You don't? Okay, well.
I saw it in here somewhere. You have something with this.
Isn't it called Cavallo or something like that?
No. Well, that's.
I mean, that's the name of the. It's the name of the cabbage.
Caballonero.
That's it.
Now, yep. When we were in Rome, we went to a trattoria, it was an osteria, actually, and the owner, who's also a chef, showed us how you cut the rib out of it and put it in ice water, and it curls up, and it's used as a salad the next day.
No, that's a different, that's not Cavallonero, that's a different
thing.
That's Punterella, there you go.
Punterella, okay, now what is the difference? That's it, because I keep trying to grow this stuff, and I guess I've been buying seeds for Cavallonero, and that's not Punterella.
No, it's not.
Cavallonero is in the cabbage family, and Punterella is in the chicory family.
Okay, but I did grow Punterella that one time, but it didn't do anything. There was no way it got ribs. What am I doing wrong here? Do you know how to do this whole thing, make it curl and everything?
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly simple. It's a matter of cutting it and then soaking it in ice water, and it just curls right up.
Okay, so Punterella is separate from Cavallonero.
The chef owner at a place called, I think it's Sabatini in Rome in Trastevere showed us how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I got it confused. We buy dinosaur kale or whatever it's called. But I tried growing Punterella.
You did, and
it was terrible.
While as a crop, it wasn't successful, so we didn't even get as far as having anything we could soak in cold water and get it to curl. We didn't get nearly that far.
Just try again.
Yeah. Now
nobody sells it.
You must be pretty fortunate though, to have access to ingredients in California.
Oh yeah, we work very closely with a lot of small farmers. We actually bring seeds back from Italy, and we have them. We have a connection with certain farmers where they grow the seeds that we bring back from Italy. So we kind of have we're just elevating the farmers as well as cuisine around here.
Yeah, that's the next thing
with new ingredients.
The farmer celebrity farmers is next.
Now you still find time to go back to Italy, Mark, Nate?
Yeah, I try to go definitely once a year, if not twice a year.
Always to the south, or you just keep on moving around?
Well, we're opening another restaurant based on Le Marche.
Oh, we've been to Le Marche.
I tend to travel there quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
We love it.
Yeah, we thought some of the food there was absolutely tremendous.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, I mean, I love southern Italy, but Le Marche is my favorite.
I love Le Marche. And you know, the other thing I love is if you buy any pasta, already made, you pick the one pasta that we love.
It's called Rusticella, and we were actually at plant.
Really?
Talking to the owner.
Yeah.
It's in your book, nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, a website for your restaurants?
A16SF.com.
And what about SPQR? Is that in the same place?
SPQRSF.com.
There you go. Naming consistency. Well, how about that?
Yeah.
Okay. When is your other restaurant open?
It should probably be open in February.
Oh,
it's
no,
going
that's
to be called
good.
Urbino.
Urbino.
There you go. That's a perfect
name.
do you know Fabio Trabocchi?
I have met him, yes.
Yeah, because he has a cookbook of recipes from Le Marche, several of which I make.
Oh, yeah, great book.
Yeah, he's a good chef.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's in a hard market in New York.
Yeah.
Anyhow, let us know when you're opening this other. What we ought to do is next time we're in San Francisco, we'll come and do all three areas, and it'll be like visiting Italy again.
Exactly, without all the driving.
Exactly. Okay, well, Nate, thank you so much.
And thanks for having me.
Thank you for a wonderful cookbook.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And now we'll go to another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're shifting into the wine arena at this point. And I think you're going to find this discussion that we had with Alice Fearing to be very interesting.
Okay, folks. We have an author on the line who has a point of view that probably 75 to 80% of the wine world doesn't agree with, but that's just something that makes it fun.
because Alice Fearing is fearless, I think. After a wonderful career in writing about wine for all kinds of distinguished publications and writing books before, one of which was a James Beard Foundation Award winner, she's just penned a book called The Battle for Wine and Love, and that's one aspect of the book, and the subtitle is How I Saved the World from Parkerization. And, of course, we're talking about the wonderful or the reviled, depending on your point of view, Senor Robert Park. Alice, welcome to the program. What was the idea behind this book?
Well, the idea behind the book was to actually come out and say what all of my colleagues with similar palates have been saying for years, like something has to be done to stop the rampant globalization of the wine world and to save wines that we love, wines that have great variety, great soul, great acidity, things that really express the place that they come from, and to save them from going extinct on us. And so that was the premise. Then the premise was outrage.
Exactly. Now, you've got a wonderful cast of characters who help you through the story. Are these real people? I mean, Owlman and Skinny and all these other characters that you mentioned?
Yes, they are absolutely. There's no fiction in that. They're all real people, but I gave them names for one very important reason is that I wanted people very much involved with the wine world to have their real names. But I felt that people in my personal life it was important for the narrative and to make books have a little bit of a point of difference and to make it more fun. But they weren't the important part. I didn't want them knowing their names just was, maybe I was also protecting my personal life too.
Is this absolutely true that your first bottle of wine was a Barolo from your father's mistress's ex-husband's wine cellar?
Well, it is the first wine that made stop and go, well, you know, I wasn't just in wine before and I was drinking the wines of the day, Lancer's Matus, you know.
Oh, please.
Experimenting with a little bit of Zinfandel when it started coming out in like the 70s. And I'd get Riesling, but it was this wine that, that Phyllis, told me to, like, go in there, take what you want. And I'd heard about Barolo, and I think I had had, so I knew I had to take that. And when I opened it, it really was one of those experiences of, like, ah, okay, this is a totally different world.
Yeah, this is real wine, right? This is real wine I'm drinking for the first time.
It was so complex, I just...
So then you set out to try to find Signor Scannavino.
Yes.
And you never found him, or if you got close, he refused to talk to you. And we were talking before we came on the program about the fact that there was some kind of scandal surrounding him. And I suggested that maybe it was something like the scandal that's now going on with Brunello di Montalcino.
Yes, I do make point often that throughout history, there's always been corruption in the wine world. And as far as with grapes from Puglia finding their way into Barolo and grapes from the south of France finding their way into Bordeaux or even Burgundy, and people were always mixing it up, even if it wasn't exactly the letter of the law. So it's nothing new. But it's something that I think will always be going on in the wine world, and the reason why there are wine laws in the first place.
But you, the scandal that you're attacking is a scandal that says not that wines perhaps might be being slightly misrepresented, but that they're being made in an artificial fashion, I think.
Exactly.
So go ahead and explain what that means.
Okay, so, and actually a very well-drawn, that there are very similar points. They're both stealing the soul of wine. Today, even though a lot of people, or actually every winemaker that I ever meet, says that the wine is made in the vineyard, more often it is grown in the vineyard because, yes, wine does grapes. But then what happens in the winery, to me, is pretty scandalous. It's then just processed and prodded and forced into a certain flavor profile through chemistry and process, through additives that most people would never tolerate in their food.
Now, do you think a lot of the responsibility of this belongs with the wine schools like UC Davis and the other ones around the world? Is that where this knowledge is coming from?
Well, it definitely is the breeding ground. And after going to UC Davis and talking a fair amount with many of the professors there, it's definitely part of the problem, because I think that their acceptance or knowledge of what I consider to be an authentic wine is, well, they might consider it flawed. They also think that their job is to teach corporate winemakers, and then winemakers can go out for themselves and find different ways. But it's kind of like the 1950s, what happened where fresh food became extinct and frozen was better than fresh and canned was better than fresh. And it took us into the dark ages of food that we didn't come out really until Alice Waters hit the scene in the late 70s. That was a long time, and a little bit that is what they are doing. And, of course, that what they're being taught is how to turn a wine into something that would please Mr. Parker's palate.
Now, I want to go down a slightly different path with you that isn't really covered in the book, but just because I'm interested in your view. When people compare the wines of the Old World and the New World, many of them say the New World wines have a tremendously unfair advantage because they're dealing with large quantities of very ripe fruit with high Brix numbers, high sugar, whatever you like to call it. At the other end of the scale, you have essentially marginal wine-growing regions, which would apply, a description would apply to most of the ones in France. Mm-hmm. Particularly Burgundy. And yet, from year to year in the New World, you'll get enormous variations in the quality of the wine, depending on the condition of the fruit and whether it's been through and all that kind of stuff. Whereas a Domaine Romani Conti or a Chateau Lafite or one of the top French wines makers almost always will make a top wine out of any vintage. And they do that skillfully by blending the different grapes together. Now, what's different about that approach to winemaking and the approach that we just talked about?
Well, actually, I have a little bit of a different take on it. I think in the New World, they are working towards consistency in the taste of vintage every year, and it is exactly what I find, that the flavor profile is very similar. And I think that when you grow grapes to such an extreme level of ripeness, it obliterates everything else. The fruit is just that fruit and sugar is just in your face.
Okay, so you think it's just the fact that the New World wine is an in-your-face kind of experience?
Yes.
And Parker likes that.
Yes, but I think if you're talking about what I talk about, like my favorite producers, goodness, I wish I could say that, well, certainly Domaine Romani Conti is, but I certainly can't afford them. But out of my favorite European producers, I will buy them in any vintage, and I'm looking forward to that difference. I'm looking forward. I know that the wine, because I know those winemakers, are going to be made beautifully. And I look forward to opening up that bottle and saying, well, it was a difficult year. It was a little bit rainy. It means that the acidity is higher. With 2005, everything was in balance. The acidity, the ripeness, it was kind of extraordinary. Kind of like the funkiness of the 2002. To me, it's more interesting. I find that way more exciting than, okay, another vintage, more wine, big deal.
Now, let's talk a little bit about wines from a different country. Right now, wines from Spain and wines from Chile are increasing in popularity. Are they different in some way? Do they add a new dimension, or are they falling into the same trap?
Very much falling in the same trap. I can't remember having a wine from Chile that I've enjoyed, and I just can't remember whether there ever has been. And I know that makes me pretty unpopular with a lot of people. It was Spain has adopted New World techniques. They're doing a lot of reverse osmosis, a lot of micro oxygenation. Excuse me for tripping over that one. And they mostly have abandoned old world techniques. Where both of those countries are very popular is that they both are delivering a lot of flavor for a certain price point.
Okay,
about the place we went to get a word in edgewise here. What about that place we visited with the two people?
Well, I was going to go to that just now. That was the reason I asked the question. I don't know if you're familiar with a wine called Rhoda.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Rhoda 1 and Rhoda 2, yeah.
We're actually going to visit Rhoda again for the first time in 10 years in about 3 weeks' time. And it was interesting. They told us that they wanted their wines to really struggle. So irrigation wasn't just something that wasn't allowed.
They didn't do anything.
It was something they would not do. And I said, life as a Rhoda grape must be really hard because the dirt was filled with rocks.
Rocky.
But the secret apparently is that vines are extraordinarily robust. They have hugely long root systems. And you mentioned controversy in California between one grower and another. One saying, I irrigate because I irrigate, And then the guy next door saying, but if you irrigate, then you're just asking your vines to become dependent on irrigation, and at some point they'll just die, and then you'll be out of the game.
Right.
So all of this kind of thing comes into it. Now, I'm interested in your take on something else, because we love this word terroir. We believe it exists. We've had discussions with winemakers from all over the place, and we think that the combination of the soil and the climate is absolutely reigns true. And one of the longest discussions we had was in Australia, where you wouldn't think people would care about that at all. What's your view of that?
About whether terroir exists?
Yes.
Oh, by all means. The question is whether somebody's growing grapes in a terroir that has something interesting to express. You know, there is, of course we know it's why that Jersey corn is famous. Why I have my favorite growers, tomatoes in the Green Marks. One is always high acid. That one is a little flabby. That one is mealy. I know people, you know, I go to certain places for root vegetables. There are certain places in the universe that just have something very interesting or perfect match for the, let's go back to grapes. That grape is grown on there and has something interesting to say. Now, what I find in the new world is that because it is new, it's new, they don't have centuries and centuries of finding that Pinot Noir is absolutely most brilliant on this dry limestone in this particular area 10 yards away from the forest. You know, we haven't gotten to the point where we actually know what is good on this plot of soil. And, you know, when I go to California, I go, you know, there is terroir to express here, but I don't understand why people are growing Pinot Noir there. For me, it just is not a grape that does well in California, but people have this very, very democratic, you know, viewpoint of, I want to grow Pinot, so I'm just going to grow it here, even though it's not the best match. And personally, I don't understand that disconnect.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, maybe it's just going to take time. Maybe this is a fad that will pass.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of funny. It's like there are these beautiful old Zinfandel vines and Carignan vines and even Grenache, like going all over California, and people are ripping them out to plant things that they think are more popular.
Well, Pinot Noir is certainly popular. If a silly movie can make a grape popular, something's really going wrong, isn't it?
I know, but the irony is that, talking about Spain, the wines from Priorat are very popular and very expensive right now, and that's Carignan grape. Seems to me to be very easy marketing to market California's the new Priorat.
Now, I think what we're going to do now before we close is we've got to come back to the Parker thing.
Okay.
And I asked Clive Coates, who I'm sure you must know.
Oh, yes, I know Clive.
I asked Clive, I said, what about Robert Parker? And he said, I said, what's the word you would use?
I know the word.
he said dangerous. I mean, maybe he said the same to you. That's the word he used.
Yeah, now, he was less polite.
He said, the funny part about it is he said Parker is a very savvy and very knowledgeable about wine. And the difficulty is that he has influence way beyond the influence that he ought to have. Mm-hmm. And I think when off the air we said, now, what percentage of the world do you think favors Robert Parker, and what percentage of the world likes the Alice Fearing point of view? And we said it was at least a 20-80 split.
At least the winemakers, but I think maybe amongst wine drinkers might be different.
Wine buyers, perhaps. Wine buyers are influenced more by Parker rather than wine drinkers?
Well, yes.
I mean, they're not necessarily the same thing, of course.
Right. But how everybody in our wine group hates Parker.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're also Francophiles and...
Well, they are Francophiles.
Callophobes.
Callophobes.
both of which, it seems, are intrinsically wrong positions.
But they do know something about wine, and they have really great wine cellars.
Yeah, but they're mostly French wines. So they're being somewhat prejudiced. They're being somewhat snobbish, in fact, in their own right. I remember it was really fun. I took a Viognier from Elk Cove, the first Elk Cove, Oregon Viognier that had ever been produced, and I took it to the blind tasting group, and I said, what is this? And they said Condria. And the funny part about it is they know I don't collect French wine, so I don't know how the hell they can twig it. So what's of the future? Do you think your book will make a difference? Do you think there'll be some kind of, no, do you think there'll be people will rebel against the numerology of Parker, or will we just get more of the same?
Well, I think it has already started. And, you know, my subtitle, How I Say the World from Parkerization, was, you know, it's kind of funny. People have said, oh, my God, what a pompous title. And hardly anybody realized that I was being so ironic. I mean, you know, like...
I think it's kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Like, and it was...
Oh, no, I thought it was ironic. I could...
Yes, good. I'm so glad. But people on the Parker Bulletin Board, whatever, they're just like...
Well, I can think of two people in the wine world I would accuse of an enormous degree of pomposity, and Alice Fearing wouldn't be one of them.
Only two?
one of them has a first name that starts with R and a second name that starts with P, and the other one has a first name that starts with M and ends with an S. and that's probably about as good a way to go out as any.
Alice, but we never asked you, how did you get involved with wine to this extent?
To this extent?
I mean, especially not being from California.
After that, I was a dance therapist. I was up in Boston. I got my master's in dance therapy, and I practiced for 10 years. Somewhere around the 8th year, I went back to writing, and I needed to write. And I moved back to New York because it was the only place that I felt that I could actually write, and I was writing plays and fiction, and I needed to call myself a writer, and so I started pitching stories about something that I knew about, and I knew something about wine at that point. I knew something about it, and of course I know a lot more now. I never went out to be a wine writer. That seemed too crazy. How could anybody say they want to be a wine writer?
Oh, lots of people.
But that's what happened. Yeah.
Well,
one thing led to another, and there you go.
Well, it was a pleasure to talk to you. I could talk to you all day. I hope you'll come back and join us on the program again
soon. That'd be great. Thank you so much. It really was a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Alice.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Alice. Bye.
Oh, that was very clever of you, the fearing and fearless. I love that.
There you go.
But now it's time for us to go to another break.
Do stay with us, because the interview coming after the break is about a detective story, a fascinating detective story in the world of exotic wines that you won't want to miss. So come and see us on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
When the book is called The Billionaire's Vinegar, you can get an idea that this might be a fairly controversial piece of publishing. And indeed it is. Having just read it from cover to cover, I know that, and we're delighted to welcome Benjamin Wallace, known to his friends as Ben, who wrote this book and published it and has attracted a fairly sizable degree of attention in the wine business, would you say, Ben?
I think that's fair to say. I'm told that it is much talked about.
Well, do you think most people have read it?
I think, people who are anywhere near to the rare and old segment of the wine business, absolutely. I mean, I think, there aren't that many books that come along that are exclusively about their field.
Now, how did you get the idea to begin the book?
Well, back in 2000, I was reading a memoir by a British wine writer named Jancis Robinson, and she kind of, in passing, mentioned this bottle, the most expensive bottle of wine ever sold, which was this supposedly 1787 Chateau Lafite, said to have belonged to Thomas Jefferson, and which had been supposedly discovered in a bricked-up cellar in Paris in the mid-80s. And then it sold to the Forbes publishing family for $105,000. So right there, I was intrigued. And then it turned out that there were all these questions about the origins of the bottle and the other bottles that were found with it. The guy who had supposedly found them, this German collector named Hardy Rodenstock, wouldn't reveal exactly where this cellar in Paris was or exactly how many bottles there were or exactly who owned the building. And there were just questions all along. And it seemed to me like this bottle might be an entree into the larger story of how, wine went from a table drink to a fetish object, and, wine prices soaring and wine becoming really a commodity. And so I thought I would try to write a book, which would be essentially a biography of this bottle and use it to tell that larger story of, how wine had transformed in that way.
Now, well,
for the record, you are professionally a writer.
That's right. I'm a magazine writer, a general interest magazine writer, not a wine specialist.
Okay.
Now, it's really interesting the way that it develops, because it becomes more than just the story of one bottle of wine. Perhaps you do discover as you go along the way that there's a much larger problem with fakes in the historical, shall we say, wine business, and you drill into all of those things as well. How much of this evidence did you have when you started the project?
Well, I knew that, you know, there were questions about the bottle. I didn't know what the answers were. I knew that, you know, there was some speculation that, you know, perhaps these bottles weren't what they were cracked up to be. I didn't know the exact nature of, you know, what that mystery might be. I mean, was it possible? There were rumors that perhaps these bottles had had some kind of illicit provenance, like perhaps they had belonged to the Nazis, and that's why Hardy Rodenstock wouldn't reveal anything about them. So it wasn't clear necessarily that this was about a counterfeiting case. It was clear just that there was a lot of murkiness around these bottles. And that was, you know, a huge part of the interest to me, was that mystery and the idea that I would try to investigate that mystery and hopefully come to some kind of answer about those questions. And while I was working on the book, I really went back and forth on whether or not the bottles were, in fact, real. I mean, it quickly developed that, you know, the Nazi story was a bit of a red herring, and that really the question with these bottles was, are they real or not? Were they actually Thomas Jefferson? Were they actually 1787 and 1784 Chateau Lafitte, Chateau Mouton, Ecam, Margaux, which were the chateaus said to have been found in this cache? And I really went back and forth on those, and there were, you know, days when I was convinced that they were real and days when I was convinced that they were fake, and then at a certain point, it became clear to me what the answer was.
Now, what page were you in the book by then? Or did you actually know what you considered to be the whole story before you actually started writing the book, or did you know part of it and then you wrote a part and then you found some more and then you wrote another part?
More the latter. You know, nonfiction is really messy because you can't control when you get what piece of information. And so, for instance, you know, maybe I, you know, was trying to get an interview with the guy who was at the center of Chapter 3, mm-hmm. but it took months to get that, and in the meantime, I got an interview with the guy at the center of Chapter 9, and so I would kind of write the book as I got the information. And so I was writing it very much out of order, and so I had to kind of keep, you know, I had a very elaborate system of note cards that I had, you know, on the wall in a big mosaic, and I was kind of constantly rearranging them and trying to figure out what went where.
But it really is, as much as anything else, in fact, a detective story, a story of how you found out as much as you could from all the players involved in the process.
Yes, I mean, in the book, I do not, you know, I am not a character in the book, but in terms of, you know, my research very much was a detective story, and that was what made it fun for me, is I was, you know, I was trying to uncover the next stone. But in the book, I lay it out more in terms of how the mystery developed within the wine world and how ultimately that mystery was investigated and cracked, not by me, but by an owner of four of the bottles named Bill Koch.
Right. Now, I had a really fascinating question. Well, I think it's an interesting question. Michael Broadbent is still out there. Michael Broadbent still writes a monthly column for Decanter Magazine, which I consider the authoritative world magazine on wine, mm-hmm. Marvin Schenken notwithstanding. I mean, how has he managed to retain that position when all the evidence you present really discredits his opinion, which was the one that launched these bottles in the first place?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. I mean, Michael Broadbent is a revered, you know, beloved figure in the wine world. He's also been a columnist for Decanter for, I forget how many years, but probably over 30 now. He remains a consultant to Christie's. Christie's even continues sometimes to include some of his notes from Rodenstock tastings in their catalogs.
Holy Moses.
I mean, it's seemingly fewer than they used to, but I still find them cropping up. So, you know, I don't know the answer to the question. I think it may be partly loyalty. I know that Michael Broadbent genuinely, amazingly, but genuinely still believes, you know, in his original authentication of these bottles.
He does.
That's
amazing. Even after all this time and even after all the evidence that you and other people assembled.
That's right. I'll tell you this. He also claims now that he didn't authenticate them, which I think is ludicrous and demonstrably false, but He does claim that, but at the same time, he, you know, vigorously will defend his decision to auction the bottle and also the case that he made for the, you know, possibility or plausibility of their having belonged to Jefferson.
So there's never ever actually been an official. Nobody's in jail, right?
Nobody is in jail, although my understanding is that, you know, there's an FBI investigation and a grand jury that has been impaneled, and my understanding is that the investigation is still open and the grand jury is still seated.
So if Mr. Rodenstock were to step into the United States, he might be in a little bit of trouble, you think?
Very, very much so. And, I mean, and in addition, there remains a civil case against Rodenstock by Bill Koch, which he filed in September of 2006.
Right, so that one's still, I mean, it's still in existence, it's just that Mr. Rodenstock won't show up, so as a result, he's outside of the jurisdiction of the particular court where this action's filed?
Well, without getting boring you with the legal details, I mean, what happened is, you know, Bill Koch sued Hardy Rodenstock in New York, and he made various arguments for why he had jurisdiction there, and then Rodenstock basically said, you know, I'm not going to even participate in this case. I don't believe you have jurisdiction. And then actually the court agreed with Rodenstock and said, that's right, you don't. But since then, Bill Koch has refiled and made additional arguments that he does have jurisdiction, and the court is currently weighing that argument.
Oh, I see. So it's still out there. So
it's still an active lawsuit that right now is before the judge in New York.
Well, Benjamin, the book is already on our website, The Billionaire's Vinegar. Listeners, you can order it from our website, and you can also keep in touch with Benjamin at his website, which is benjaminwallace.net. And, you know, I was surprised, Benjamin, you're also moving on. You're not entrapped in the wine world. You're moving on, doing a very interesting book about somebody who was in a coma in a small town in Poland for 20 years. So you're moving
article.
On. Oh, it's not a book. It's a magazine article.
Yes.
Okay.
I have just one final question for Ben. Aside from the fact that I asked him before he came on the air, is he frequently mistaken for the ex-Detroit Pistons basketball player? He said no. It's something to do with how tall he is. but I'm wondering if you have an observation for our listeners generally, some of who might be wine collectors and who might be tempted as a result of all the work you did. Would you hazard a guess at what percentage of these truly historical and unique wines are actually fakes?
Yeah, I couldn't give you a percentage because I really don't know the answer. What I can tell you is that, you know, in certain wines and certain vintages, it's almost as likely that something is fake as that it's real. And
to give you one
example, I mean, and perhaps the most famous example, the 1947 Cheval Blanc is probably considered the most faked wine in the world. And I think it's really hard to find an authentic specimen. And even if you find an authentic specimen, to even know that it's authentic. And I went to a tasting in L.A. in November hosted by, you know, the preeminent rare wine tasting organizer, Bipin Desai. And even, you know, and he had gotten three 1947 Cheval Blancs for this tasting. And even, you know, Bipin, who has better access than anybody and more experience in determining whether these are real or not, you know, one of the bottles before the tasting was withdrawn because he decided it was fake. And then of the two that were opened, there was debate about one of them. So, I mean, even among... Yeah, and there were so many very experienced people there, and they couldn't even agree among themselves as to whether one of these bottles was real or not.
Isn't that amazing? So the term caveat emptor probably is a wise thing to have in mind if you're in the business of trying to collect famous antique wines.
It's essential because the auction houses, that's the level of responsibility they take. They just say caveat emptor.
Hmm. Well, wow. Ben, thank you so much for joining the program, and thank you for a fascinating read. I've been reading this. It's taken me a good deal of time over the last couple of weeks, but I really enjoyed the story. It was really quite gripping, and I'm guessing it's not over. So if Mr. Rodenstock ever comes to justice, I'll bet you're going to pick up your pen again, and you'll be sure to let us know when you do that.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
Oh, okay, Benjamin, it was a great time talking to you and reminiscing about Philadelphia.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, I guess that's a wrap for another week.
Come back and join us again next week, same time, same place, at www.onthemenuradio.com, and we'll see you then.
Bye-bye.